Item five, which is the Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation Action Update, and this is a briefing. Dr. Lowry?
There was no Dan Torres coming up with a conflict. He's a great guy.
He's been there?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Okay.
Dr. Lowry.
Morning, gentlemen.
How
you doing there?
Yeah.
This is Dr. Lowry and Dan Tuns from NOAA.
Yep.
Yeah.
Remember, I want to talk about the flood stuff, too.
Right.
Do it after this.
Right after this, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Hey.
Set us free.
All right. Mr. Commissioner, members of the Commission, Mr. Director, Mr. Deputy Director, good morning, and thank you for having us here today. As noted, I'm Dr. Dave Lowry with the Marine Fish Science Unit, and with me today I've got one of my federal collaborators, Mr. Dan Tunis, and this is a spin-off or kind of a secondary briefing from a briefing that we gave to the Commission back in June of this year. And at that time, we were briefing on the state's rockfish recovery plan and conservation actions over the last several years. And at several points during that presentation, we mentioned federal collaboration on different projects, some ESA listings of three specific rockfish species. And so this is a follow-up that was requested from that initial briefing. So for the presentation today, just to get us all on the same page, make sure that we're all covering the same background, we're going to talk about the recent history of rockfish management in Puget Sound. We'll also talk about the ESA listing of canary, yellow eye, and Picasso rockfish. And then we'll do an overview of the state's rockfish conservation plan. Again, just a fairly quick overview to make sure that we're all on the same page. We'll then talk about recovery planning for these three ESA-listed species, and at that point, for the most part, Dan will take over, talking about the composition of the team, what those recovery teams do, in general, how a recovery team functions, and then specifically how these rockfish recovery team, or the rockfish recovery team has been working. Then we'll also highlight a couple of really high-profile research projects that we've been engaged in the last couple of years, one of which is having potentially profound effects on these ESA listings. And I'll let Dan go into that so that you hear it from the feds rather than me. We'll then talk about kind of the proposed timeline for moving forward and some of the other issues that we're dealing with. So to start off with, I said I deal with recent rockfish management. I'm going to start in 1996. That may not seem all that recent, but it actually does reflect a really important change in our rockfish management strategy as a state. And that's when, in 1996, the Commission adopted the policy that basically recognized that many species of groundfish in Puget Sound were in trouble. We had seen declines in fisheries. There were declines in encounter rates, a variety of different things. And so in 1996, the Commission officially said, we want to put it on the record. We recognize that there is trouble. And so in 1998, we formalized a groundfish management plan as an agency. And this plan called for a bunch of different things, but one of the big things it called for was species group-specific assessments and status evaluations, and then, if necessary, conservation and recovery plans. So over the next several years, compiling a bunch of different data, doing some studies targeted at specifically assessing rockfish, we started to get towards a rockfish conservation plan. In 2007, there were five species of rockfish that were petitioned for ESA listing. So on the federal side of things, the lower side of this timeline, in 2007, the federal petition came in. We were still doing research. As a state, we were still developing our conservation plan. And in 2009, we formally released this, this biological and assessment report. Now, shortly thereafter, in 2010, a lot of different things happened, and this was really a linchpin year for rockfish in general, and specifically ESA-listed rockfish. So in 2010, the petition was basically completed. A biological review team on the federal side of things came together and completed their assessment, and they listed canary and yellow-eye rockfish as threatened and Picasso as endangered. Now you'll see on the other side of the timeline, on the upper side of it, at this point, WDFW closed all fisheries for rockfish in Puget Sound. There are still minor fisheries for black and blue rockfish up in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but essentially the entire Puget Sound was closed down for rockfish retention. And we also put into effect a 120-foot depth limit for targeted bottom fish fisheries. And this was to avoid barotrauma, or trauma associated with these fish coming up from a high-pressure situation up onto the surface into a low-pressure situation. So in 2010, a lot of different things happened. In 2011, the department finalized and completed our Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation and Recovery Plan, and this is for all species of rockfish in Puget Sound, not just the ESA-listed species. And this was the conservation plan that we had been developing since the late 90s, when in 1998 we developed the groundfish management plan. So this is that species group-specific plan I was talking about. Now, initially, I kind of left it here, but at Craig Burley's prompting, I added a few things that we've been doing since, just so that these activities didn't appear to end in 2011. We've by no means been sitting on our hands. So since then, we've been doing ROV-based assessments, which we briefed the commission on. We've been doing a lot of education and outreach, genetic analyses, some of which we'll talk about today. Lots of fisheries monitoring, critical habitat identification and designation, barotrauma research, a variety of different things. But all of these are leading to other significant management actions. But in 2011 was kind of the last major action that occurred. So what does our conservation plan hold for all species of rockfish? Well, what it tries to do is outline a comprehensive approach to the assessment and conservation of these species using sound scientific data. So it's got lots of different components. Specifically, it also identifies data gaps and priority actions that should occur. It does recognize the three ESA-listed species. As I said, they were listed in 2010. The plan was about to be released in 2010 and was rewritten to adjust for and account for these ESA-listed species. But in most cases, what we could do to adjust and account for these species was say they have many of the same gaps that we have for other rockfish species, but apparently their populations are even at lower levels. So it really kind of recast the focus of that plan for those species. Funding and staff time in the plan are focused on a couple of very specific actions. Number one was to reduce fishery mortality, and that's both directed fisheries mortality, that's why we closed down several of these fisheries, and then bycatch mortality as well. So several fisheries like targeted groundfish gillnet fisheries that were usually catching dogfish also had a potential side effect of bycatching these ESA-listed fish now. So those were also closed down in 2010. We also focused effort on removing derelict gear and preventing reaccumulation, and this has mostly been in partnership with a couple of different entities, the Northwest Straits Foundation and a subcontractor to them, Natural Resource Consultants. We also sought to determine the distribution abundance and habitat associations for these fish. So as crazy as it sounds, there's actually several rockfish species that we know so little about that we're not even sure where to go and find them. So there are some species that occur so infrequently that when somebody asks, well, where would you even go to study them? The answer is probably deep and maybe over rock. We thought we could do better. So we've spent the last several years doing better. We also sought to evaluate the effects of those fisheries changes and to estimate the actual bycatch from fisheries that were not closed. So a big deal here is if you close down the fisheries with the assumption that it's going to reduce directed mortality, that's a pretty obvious assumption, but especially these ones that still have potential bycatch, we needed to evaluate those and see really what the level of bycatch was and just how much of a threat then it maintained for these populations. Another major focus was to educate and engage the public, and we've been doing a lot on this, attending various meetings and presenting at dive clubs and Puget Sound angler groups and CCA, and we do talks at the Seattle Aquarium and Point Defiance on a regular basis, just trying to make sure that because the fisheries are closed, people don't forget that rockfish are out there and species, a group of species that we manage. So it's a very important thing to keep the public engaged on this. Did I miss one? Oh. And then the last thing on here, which is really what we're here to focus on today, is because of these three ESA-listed species, we needed to work with the federal government to develop recovery plans for these species. So this is, again, focused on just these three ESA-listed species. All of the other actions were for all rockfish species in Puget Sound. So now I'll let Dan talk a little bit about the recovery team.
Yeah, so this briefing really doesn't go into much detail about the draft recovery plan. We're still revising it and working on it. And we have a couple really important research projects that we'll spend most of our time talking about. But just to give you a flavor of the work that we're doing on the federal recovery plan for the three listed rockfish, we've been meeting for the last several years to develop this draft plan. And since early in the spring of this year, we really have stopped meeting as a team because the draft plan went out for peer review and for co-manager review. In the meantime, we had some very important work going on with the genetic analysis, which we'll be talking about today. Our intent was to get a draft recovery plan out this year for public review. But once we saw the beginnings of the genetic analysis, we called a timeout on that so we could make sure that the plan reflected the best available information. Obviously, we didn't want to redo work that was already of high quality, so a lot of the elements of the state's rockfish conservation plan are lifted over and put into the draft federal plan as well. So the composition of the team, we have two state employees, Dave Lowry and Bob Pekunski with WDFW. With the University of Washington, we have Don Gunderson, Lawrence Hauser, who is a geneticist, and Terry Klinger. Jason Cope and Kelly Andrews and myself are on the team. And we've kind of had a sequence of folks with the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. Keith Lutz began, and then Will Beatty. Both of those guys retired. I hope it's not a correlation with the work on the draft plan. And then now we have Chris James. So the groups that are helping form this plan and the individuals, I think, really reflect a really balanced expertise. You know, we just don't have fishery managers, but we have folks that are experts on genetics and the Puget Sound ecosystem. So the elements of recovery planning and the recovery plan itself, we have to identify the background and identify the threats for the three listed rockfish. We do that on a specific as possible basis. So we describe Hood Canal and South Sound and the Central Sound and the San Juans because they're all different from each other in terms of biological condition. And then we have recovery strategies that includes research and management actions. Within the plan itself, there's recovery criteria that are based on the biology and characteristics of the three listed populations and threats-based criteria to go along with those. Basically, the goal of the recovery plan is to get to those points where we can consider delisting. We also have an implementation schedule and preliminary cost estimates. And this, all of these elements are common to the NOAA federal recovery plans for salmon and other species. And then importantly, the draft plan, when it's issued, will be put out for public comment, and we'll have a series of public meetings and then revise and finalize it. And I won't spend too much time on this slide, but just to reiterate the Dave's earlier slide, there's been quite a bit of work going on over the last several years as we kind of build a recovery plan. Back in 2007, the state started some really important ROV work, and that has continued up through now and continuing to work. We had a rockfish workshop in 2011. Where we gathered together interested folks in rockfish, not just the three listed rockfish. And at that point, we formed kind of a voluntary group of folks to help us develop the recovery plan and to collaborate, and that's known as the Rockfish Work Group, folks consisting of state government, NGOs like Puget Sound Anglers and the Seattle Aquarium are kind of on the ad hoc group that meets from time to time. We also had really important work with the University of Washington where we had outreach with recreational fishing interests and fishermen. Within that project, we interviewed over 500 anglers to see what their views on rockfish recovery would look like and get an understanding of what they know about rockfish. And as Dave mentioned, there's been quite a bit of work on preventing derelict fishing gear from happening and removing it. And a really important element of all of this has been the cooperative research that we've done with fishermen. So now we'll dive into the genetic work. There's there's a several different criteria for NOAA to identify a distinct population segment, and that's really a key point for us to list a species, is to identify whether or not it is a DPS, and then identify its biological condition to make a determination if it should be on the list or not. So there's two steps that simplify. The first one is that the species must be called distinct. And there's different ways to identify that. You can look at the ecology of the region that it occupies, but you can also look at its life history and genetics. At the time that we listed the three listed rockfish, we didn't have any direct genetic information aside from a little bit for yellow eye. And that was a real key point of uncertainty. And then if they're determined to be distinct, then we have to see if it determined that group of fish is significant to the overall species. So again, you can look at the habitat that they occupy, et cetera, to determine if they're significant. But the genetic work really has informed the distinctness question of the DPS policy. Go ahead. So the DPS area is outlined in the black, and that was determined by our biological review team back in 2009 to 2010. That area represents what's called the Puget Sound Georgia Basin, and the DPS area is common for each of the three listed species of rockfish, including yellow eye, canary on the right, and bokashio on the bottom.
So, excuse me. So we mentioned that we've been doing ROV studies since about 2007, but specifically relevant to the DPS, we did several studies in 2008 and 2010 that were focused in the North Sound area, specifically the San Juans. And while we had done a sound-wide survey in 2012 and 13, we were essentially missing information for really prime habitat in the rest of Puget Sound. And so what we've done this past year, 2015, starting in about March, and intend to do into 2016 and then potentially 2017, is we developed a model that specifically looked for shared habitat attributes in the rest of Puget Sound and tried to use the information that we had collected from the San Juans to predict where fish might occur in the rest of Puget Sound. And so we stratified and used this model called a maximum entropy model to develop predictions for the likelihood of occurrence of rockfish in Puget Sound proper, so essentially south of Port Townsend, where we're sitting right here. So south of Port Townsend and inside of Deception Pass was our potential survey area. And so in 2015, we had initially targeted something like 480 stations. We currently have 464 stations that are finished, and we have seen several dozen ESA-listed rockfish. Many of these came from areas in Hood Canal, southern portions of Hood Canal, up into Daybob Bay. We've seen them in Central Sound. We've seen them in a variety of locations now. The one exception is that we've not yet encountered any ESA-listed rockfish south of the Tacoma Narrows. So nothing in South Sound at this point. Video review is ongoing, so as you can imagine, and as I've briefed the commission on before, for about every hour that we spend underwater with the ROV, we have about 6 to 8 hours of video analysis that has to occur. For this survey, because we're really only focused on these three species, we've truncated that a bit, and so we have kind of a first pass analysis, and then we have a more complete analysis that follows our broader kind of ecosystem protocols for reviewing this video. So we're actually counting everything, finally categorizing the habitat. But for these surveys, we're doing about an hour to an hour and a half of video review for every hour of video collected. So at this point, we have just over 225 hours of video, and we have three people cranking away at trying to review that video and really pull all of the detail they can out of it. We have a similar design for 2016. So for the month of January, we're basically taking the ROV offline, and we're really going to focus on fixing a few kind of glitches and nagging issues that we've been having. But from February forward, we're going to cover about another 400 stations in the rest of, or in this same area of Puget Sound. These are different randomly selected locations, though. So some of these areas up here that may not have been selected in the 2015 survey may get more heavily selected in 2016.
So the next few slides, we'll be talking specifically about the genetic research that has gone on over the past couple of years. And it's really important to understand that this work has really been successful because of the partnership that we've had with the state and to recreational fishing interests such as Puget Sound Anglers and the ROV survey. During the course of this work, which is just wrapped up this fall, we actually hired 9 fishing captains in the Puget Sound on 73 fishing trips with 98 volunteers. And a lot of the volunteers were organized with Puget Sound Anglers, so they were members that came out and actually fished as to attempt to get genetic samples for these 3 listed rockfish. The central question in here was to determine whether or not the genetics of these 3 listed fish were dissimilar between the Puget Sound and the coast. So we had selective sampling focused within each of those regions that you see there, including the Washington coast. So the stratum was really set up to get samples within each of those areas. Okay. So the fishing itself was really a very focused, targeted effort to try to catch listed rockfish. And when we thought of this idea a couple years ago, it was almost a crazy notion to go out and to actually get enough samples. Because we thought that these fish were so very rare. The way that we did it is we went to areas that were identified in the past as having these fish, whether they were in fishing guidebooks or in the memory of a fishing captain, and also with current ROV sightings. So we would go to these focused areas and fish to try to catch these fish. We used hook and line sample methods. We basically left it up to the captain to take us to the spots with their gear, with their equipment, and to do the best to catch the fish. Once we did catch the fish, we took the length, weight, and sex. We took a fin clip for that genetic analysis. Most of the fish we put on an external Floy tag on the fish with a unique number on that. And then the fish was released with a descending device. If you look where Dave has the arrow there, that's a sequelizer. It's a really neat device that is specially designed to capture the lip of the rockfish and release that fish back near the depth that it was captured at. So there's a sensor within that device that actually opens up the crimpers and allows the fish to swim free. So it gives the fish its best shot to survive after being brought up from depth. So after a couple years of effort, we actually did get samples. Starting on the outer coast, those samples came from ongoing research over the last several years within trawl surveys. So we processed 30 yellow eye and 30 canary samples. Within the Straits of Juan de Fuca, we got 19 yellow eye and 22 canary. Within Hood Canal, we got 16 yellow eye, and we weren't able to get any canary. In South Sound, we weren't able to catch anything. In the Central Sound, we got 5 yellow eye, 25 canary, and to our delight, we actually got 3 bokashio samples. And in the San Juans, we had 28 yellow eye and 26 canary, which is really cool because we were able to do a genetic analysis on each of these groups of fish. And I got to say that the ROV survey was really critical to find these fish in Central Sound. We were able to find fish to catch everywhere else. But in the Central Sound, it was really tough. And coincidentally, the ROV research was going on at the same time as the genetic work. And we were able to see these fish with the ROV and the next week go and fish in these precise spots. And it really turned the tide to allow us to get a lot more samples for each of the 3 listed rockfish. So I'm not a geneticist, so I'm not able to give you a great deal of background on the methodologies that were used within the genetic analysis. They were done with our scientists at our science center. But from what I understand, the methods that were used, Dave can speak to this a little bit more if you have questions, are new. They're relatively new. It's a restricted site-associated DNA sequencing method. And the key part of this is that it allows a pretty robust genetic analysis on a small number of samples. So here's a slide of the results for yellow-eye rockfish. And starting on the left side of the graph, it shows a series of black dots. And those are samples from fish that were outside of the DPS, outside of the designated area, from the Washington coast, et cetera, and the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And those fish, you can see, are clustered together. The yellow fish are fish that were sampled within the DPS. That includes samples that we got from Canada. DFO gave us several archive samples of yellow eye, which was great. And the top circle there are fish from Hood Canal, yellow eye rockfish from Hood Canal. And the bottom circle are the rest of the DPS area from the Central Sound to the San Juans to the inside of Vancouver Island. So it's an interesting story that we're still interpreting. Essentially what we're seeing is there's three separate clusters of fish, as you can see. Also note that there was some fish from the outer coast found within the DPS, within Central Puget Sound. Those are those black dots that are grouped with that lower circle there, and including a couple outlier fish that were kind of bridging between the two groups. So I guess the take-home message at this point is that the genetic work helped validate the initial finding back in 2010 that these fish are actually distinct from the outer coast. It was an interesting surprise to see this Hood Canal cluster as well. So for yellow eye, what it looks like that we'll be proposing is to extend the northern boundary up in Canada a bit further north, because those fish, they matched up genetically with the fish to the south. And just to back up a little bit, our intention is to get a five-year review. The Endangered Species Act requires a five-year review of species condition, and that is due around the end of March next year. And our initial interpretation of these genetic findings will be in that five-year review. And after that, we'll probably go through a rulemaking proposal. And one of the aspects of that rulemaking proposal will be to extend the boundary up in Canada a bit further north. We don't have any control over what Canada does with these fish, but it best reflects the biological unit. So go ahead.
How do you deal with the difference between the inshore, essentially the Salish Sea groupings in Hood Canal versus those in BC? It looks to me like in your principal component analysis, they were distinct.
Yeah, so backing up, that's a good question. The short answer is there's two potential ways to interpret that. And keep in mind, I'm way ahead of my agency right now, all right? But there's two potential ways to deal with that. One of them is to identify within the recovery plan two populations of yellow-eyed rockfish, analogous to having 22 populations of Puget Sound Chinook. Okay, so that's one way to do it, and that's probably the path that we'll take. The other alternative is to go through basically the process of identifying if those Hood Canal fish are themselves and own a DPS among themselves. those are the two scenarios that I see, and I can't answer at this point which path we're going to take, but my hunch is going to be the former, where we identify two populations.
So BC seems to have a large area where this DPS occurs. Does that count in terms of the U.S. Endangered Species Act?
We don't have any management control over those fish, obviously. The difference really is that moving forward, the condition of those fish in Canada matters. So if those yellow-eye populations rebound, as we hope, that would help the overall status of the DPS.
Even though those increases had not occurred in the U.S.?
I'm trying to decide how far to get in the weeds on this. Within the recovery plan, the delisting and downlisting criteria will specifically identify the biological condition that's needed to delist yellow eye. And we will need to see improvement of yellow eye populations within the U.S. waters to delist. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, that answers it. Thank you.
So for can it, go ahead.
Can you speak to that? Are you seeing an increase?
We don't know. We don't have good baseline information about yellow-eye rockfish condition to really answer that. And that's really one of the main objectives of this ROV survey that's going on right now, is to get a baseline condition for these fish. How big are they? What habitat are they using? And how frequent are they?
Okay.
My genetics was many, many years ago, and it's advanced considerably. But going back to the first slide on the distinct populations of the yellow eye, are there really two distinct populations there, or there must be a continuum? Are they interacting or interbreeding, which would account for a distinct population, I guess, that's hybrid?
It's a good question. The genetic information is telling us no. Even the fish that you see in the black circles within Puget Sound that have the same genetic material as the Washington coast, there isn't evidence that those two fish are having young. That could change moving forward, but we don't see evidence for that. Yeah. So this slide up here shows the genetic results for canary rockfish. And you can see that the black circles also indicate samples of fish that were caught outside the Puget Sound, Georgia Basin, compared to inside, which are the red circles. And we're really seeing one pandemic population of fish. And this is very strong evidence that fish within the Puget Sound are not distinct. For Boccaccio, we were really surprised and happy to get three samples. But we didn't really have enough genetic samples and analysis to come to a conclusion one way or the other. It's difficult to see in the slide up here, but you can see that the red triangle that Dave is pointing out show the two samples that we've processed so far. And to make the results even more ambiguous, one of the Boccaccio caught in central Puget Sound was very different, relatively different from the other groups of fish. The other sample of a Boccaccio caught in Puget Sound was grouped with fish from the outer coast. So it's a very ambiguous result, and we've only processed two samples and have three total. So the long and short of it is we're not going to be proposing any change for Bokashio, but we are prioritizing trying to get additional samples. We are trying to, just this week, work with fishing captains to outfit them with the gear to take a genetic sample if they happen to catch a Bokashio by accident. And hopefully over the next few years we can amass enough samples, which would be maybe a dozen more, to do a similar genetic analysis. For canary, we're going to be proposing to delist and take canary off the endangered species list. Like I said earlier, that would be done in a proposed rule, likely in the first half of 2016. That would go out for public comment. And then a final rule after that, after we consider public comment. In that same proposal, we'll propose to extend the northern boundary for yellow eye up in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Keogh.
As far as the idea of delisting canaria, what's the basis for that?
Yeah, good question. Remember back to the slide on how a distinct population segment is defined. The first question is whether that group of species or fish is discrete. And one of the key ways that you can answer that question is genetic information. What we're seeing for canary is that those fish are not genetically distinct from the rest of the canary population.
The coastal population.
At that point, it's not a DPS. Yep.
So Dan talked a little bit earlier about how we were combining the ROV survey and the genetic work that we've been doing, and I just wanted to highlight another couple of essentially just really cool, interesting observations that we've made in the last year here. One is that, as we mentioned, one of our methods when we catch these fish with the recreational hook and line techniques and have them on board is we put an external Floy tag on them. And what that allows us to do is go back and try to resite these fish so that we can look at potentially individual growth. We can look at whether fish are hanging around in a given area, how long they hang around in those areas. So there's a lot of potential information we can get here with these external tags because we can resite them with the ROV. And even though it seems like a total long shot, again, we thought, you know, maybe we'd be able to go out and get 30, 40 fish in total. Believe it or not, we've actually been able to resite some of those Floy tags. So you can see an example here, this long yellow strand coming from the dorsal fin sticking out the top side of this fish is a Floy tag. And we've recently upgraded. We've now got two cameras on the ROV. One of them is a high-definition camera that can zoom. And so what we've actually been able to do is pull up to a fish like this when we see the external tag, sit close enough that we can zoom in and actually read the tag number off of it if it's in the right orientation. So we can get really detailed information on how long these fish are there, how big they are, when they were caught, when they were released, when they're resighted. Another really great thing, and this is, again, one in a million observation, but you can see this fish has a tag that's partially cut out of the frame here, but it's heading up off the dorsal side of it. This fish was actually tagged on the boat. It was identified as a female at the time of capture, but was not gravid. It was not brooding eggs, was not brooding young at the time of capture. We then sighted it with the ROV over 6 months later, same location, brooding young. So do descending devices work? Yes. Do they work well enough to put a fish down on the bottom and give it a chance at reproductive success? Well, yeah, it's only one, but yes, the answer is we've proven without a doubt it can work. Does it always work? Well, that's where statistics come into the game. But we do have a female fish that was tagged, descended, brooded young, and is now contributing to the population.
One question.
Sure.
Can you use the number of resighted animals as in some sort of estimate of abundance?
At this point, I would say that our sample size is just far too low to do that. Realistically, there are a lot of assumptions that you have to do with most of those models about closed populations and no immigration into or immigration from the population, that you've had limited mortality. There are a variety of assumptions there that I think we'd be breaking pretty rapidly. We could potentially, though, I mean, this has been done on a sound-wide basis, so could we go to a specific area where we find a high density of these fish and try and do some really rapid tagging and then some rapid monitoring for a short period of time, potentially? And that could be a potential option for a localized area.
Just to summarize, what we're looking forward to in 2016, the five-year review will be out in late March with a little luck and timely review. That'll really describe the what we know over the past 5 years changed for these fish. So that'll do an assessment of their biological condition and also their habitat. And it will also include the new genetic information. After that, we'll likely have a proposed rule to delist Canary and extend that northern boundary for yellow eye at the least. And then after that would be finalized, we will be free to start moving again on the recovery plan, and hopefully that'll go out as a draft next year, perhaps in the first half of next year. I'd be happy to come back and brief you if you like to really dive into the details of the recovery plan. But I can't underscore enough that the genetic information really was critical for us to get a recovery plan out in the future that it reflects reality. So very pleased that we're able to get this project funded and going. And just to give you a real quick an analogy or a little tidbit from that work and how critical it was to work with fishermen to collect that data, the third Boccaccio that we caught was in Port Susan. And if you know Port Susan, it's really muddy. You don't think of rockfish when you think of Port Susan. I wasn't on the boat that day, but the gentleman, one of the volunteer anglers, they were kind of brainstorming in the morning about where to go fishing. And he said, gosh, you know, believe it or not, I remember catching Boccaccio in Port Susan. And this was a memory that goes back 30 years. And he convinced the captain to drive up there from Edmonds and fish this one little spot. And they caught a canary and a Boccaccio in that same spot. That wouldn't have happened if it was just the state government or the federal government working in isolation from fishermen. And so I really do want to thank the volunteer fishermen and especially Puget Sound anglers for rounding them up to get that done.
So just to summarize here, again, we noted population issues with rockfish in general and specifically with these ESA-listed species as early as the mid-90s. And we really did some intense data collection and analysis through the 2000s. This led ultimately to our WDFW status assessment and conservation plan for all rockfish species in Puget Sound in 2009. And in this, we identified research and management priorities, some of which we've briefed you on today, some of which we just covered in minimal detail, but all of which are available in various reports and documents. In 2010, these three species, canary, yellow eye, and Boccaccio, were listed. The recovery team was then convened after kind of an interim recovery team was established, as Dan described. And ultimately, the draft recovery plan is now nearing completion. We clearly had it most of the way and then had this hiccup of the new genetic data really showing us something interesting and new. And that's where the processes that Dan's been talking about essentially going back and recognizing the DPS that was established for canaries was inappropriate and, in fact, is not a standalone segment. It's not significant and or discrete. So reconsidering that before moving forward with this recovery plan became something that essentially stopped us cold, and we had to kind of wait for that process to continue its way through. The five-year review by the biological review team, again, we're hoping for March, but early 2016, one way or the other. And the recovery plan will then be out in spring or depending on when the BRT's five-year review is complete, sometime in the first half of 2016 anyway. So at this point, we'll take any additional questions you have. And as Dan noted, both he and I are happy to do any follow-ups with you or any members of the public that have interest in these topics.
Thank you, Dave and Dan. Yes.
Start.
I'll go ahead.
No, just move on this way.
Well, I guess we'll start off with a simplistic question, because I've sat here and listened to this and been very intrigued by the science. But what are you feeling that are the limiting factors on rockfish? What has got us to this point? And I know it's a simple question, but I'm still, and what would we do to move forward?
There was overharvest occurring up until the 90s. And clearly, I think the condition of these fish was heavily influenced by the removal of so many. What we're faced with now is really a tough question of how does fishing now affect these populations, because there's been so many closures that have occurred to protect them. How would additional bycatch in other open fisheries affect these fish? And it's a really good question and a very tough one to answer. In the meantime, Puget Sound has changed significantly. You're well aware of the shoreline armoring that has gone on in most of the Central Sound. And there's a number of other factors, such as the loss of large areas of kelp, that really can influence the productivity of these fish. But it's at this point, aside from obvious things like derelict fishing gear, it's difficult to find a real smoking gun about what to identify moving forward.
Another critical element that may head off some questions, we'll see, but another critical element for these species specifically is that they're very long-lived, and they don't mature until well into their lives. So for some rockfish species, they may live 100-plus years. They may not even have the capacity to reproduce until they're in their teens or 20s. And so we often get the question, well, we shut down fisheries 5 years ago. They're not recovered yet? Well, no, the simple answer is many of the fish that were there when we shut down the fisheries haven't even reached sexual maturity yet. So their chance to contribute to the population isn't even there yet. And so it may take another 10, 15 years before we get enough fish that are reproductively viable enough and there are enough of them to interact with one another to really start bolstering these populations and start to see a recovery signal.
I'd like to start by commending you on your cooperative efforts, not only between the federal and state agencies, but by incorporating the recreational fishing community in this. And I'd like to single out Puget Sound anglers and what they've contributed to this. And I kept hearing from them on a fairly regular basis, especially from Ron, on what are we doing here? Are we collecting samples that are going to hang us out to dry here eventually when it comes to genetic information? I don't think it has raised the stakes. I think what you've done in so doing is you've nailed down what really needs to be done when it comes to a recovery plan. So again, I think you're to be commended for this. This is an amazing cooperative effort in my view, and I hope it's a new look with NOAA. And I think that Dan has been more than receptive to working with everybody on this. So congratulations. I have a question, though, and that has to do with predation. How do you deal in the recovery plan with potential predation from animals such as harbor seals, which are increasing all the time in Puget Sound, large numbers of harbor seals? Now, my sense with harbor seals is that the data shows that they prey on rockfish very infrequently, but when you have, 20,000 of these things out there feeding small bits of rockfish, are they affecting recovery?
Yeah, it's a good question. In the recovery plan, it identifies predation as an issue that we don't know a lot about, and not just harbor seals, but lingcod and other sources of predation. So really, at this point in the recovery plan, it's identified as a research need to help quantify how much predation is happening. I will say, though, that particularly for yellow eye and bacacio, the adult stage lives very deep. Their coloration is very cryptic, and they have venomous spines. all built to avoid predation from harbor seals. Not to say that it doesn't occur, but these fish are really designed to live a long time, aside from living within very small areas within rocky habitat. So they're really built to avoid predation. I guess the real question is, what happens before that life stage, at the juvenile stage when they're more vulnerable, or the larval stage when they're perhaps more vulnerable to predation? So at this point, it really is a research question within the recovery plan.
Thank you. Commissioner Carpenter.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank my colleague, Mr. Mencken, for bringing up the two items that I was going to bring up, the thank you and the predation issue.
Well said. Commissioner Grable.
Thank you for pointing out the longevity of these species, and it is frustrating. I know anglers expect, you know, instant results, and in this particular case, it's going to take particular patience. However, because of the closure of season, say, for dragging and other methods of gathering these fish commercially, have we seen any recovery of habitat for these fish during this period that you could identify?
So directly quantifying what habitat was there before and after dragging, and you know how it might have changed over time, is difficult, especially in the deep waters. Using drop cams and ROVs and other tools like that that really give you eyes on the bottom is a relatively new thing. Quite honestly, we're actually working to address this question right now because of a specific inquiry we had for a Puget Sound Anglers meeting that we're attending, I think, in January. And the question was, essentially, where did they used to trawl? And now that you've been down there with the ROV, were they messing up rocky habitats?
Sure.
Were they knocking over pinnacles? Were they, you know, breaking things off? And I would say kind of the simple answer is, if you're fishing with a trawl vessel and you're dragging a net along the bottom, the worst choice you can make is to drag that along rock, because it bangs up your net, tears it up, you might lose the whole thing. It's inefficient in a lot of ways to do that. Dragging in proximity to rocks is usually a good idea, because you're trying to pick fish off on the fringes. So there's definitely the question of where did they drag, and what, now that we know more about the habitat, what does that habitat look like in those areas?
Right.
So we're actually going back and overlaying historic drag locations with what we now know about the habitat and what we've visually directly observed. And for the most part, what we're finding is we find very few locations where trawls and good rockfish habitat actually coincide. There is some fringe area, but it's kind of the fringes of a good spot where typically one person was successful, and then for a couple of years, several fishermen would fish in that vicinity. But the overlap between trawlable habitat, where they really could and would trawl, and this good rockfish habitat is pretty minimal.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter, one more time.
Dan, I'd heard anecdotally here a couple weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, about some work done in Alaska, southeast Alaska, I think, on some yellow eye and fish descender. Do you have any perspective on that and the success rate?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to, there's a new paper that came out this year. The study that was done was following up on a tagging project for yellow eye, where they tagged, you know, 15 or 30 fish and released them with descending devices. And another researcher came in and 2 or 3 years later, and she resampled those fish. So she found, I think, 15 yellow eye that were females that were still alive. And her research specifically was looking at whether there was evidence that those fish were reproducing. I can't give you the percentage of fish that they found that were reproducing, but it was pretty high. So there's good evidence that female yellow eye within that study are actually reproducing, just as we showed you the picture of. So it's very good news as far as using descending devices.
Was there any depth correlation or comments about that?
I don't think the sample number was sufficient to
do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was essentially one localized reef, one localized population they were dealing with. So, yeah, the depth variation was very minimal.
Okay.
Any final questions? Thank you, Dave and Dan. And I trust this will be gotten into the literature at some point.
Absolutely.
Good, good. Again, I share the compliments and the issues raised. Good study. Great area of collaboration. Thanks, Ron, for Puget Sound Partnership stuff and Puget Sound Anglers. So, thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Can I have one thing?
Well, of course you may.
This is going to be quick. But you're talking about structure. Are you aware that DNR is out there removing tire reefs around the fishing piers as a cleanup, derelict boats, and no structures going back in? The Muckleteel fuel docks. Yes, we have creosote there, but a lot of it's grown over. All that's going down. We're removing structure all over the Puget Sound, not replacing it while we're trying to go back and replenish ESA-listed rockfish. That seems to be a problem to me. I just want people to understand that we are, while we're talking about structure, what can be done to habitat structure, if more is coming out with nothing going back.
So I imagine that will be in your recommendations that as well.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and artificial structure, artificial habitat enhancement is something that was dealt with in our state conservation plan. It'll be in the federal recovery plan. We recently revised our WACs for HPAs, and there's actually a new section about kind of the hurdles to and the bars that we need to cross to be able to do that.
Okay, so thank you, Dave, and thanks, Ron, for adding that. Before we break for lunch, I'm going to turn the mic over to Joe for a minute or so.
Thank you, guys. Chair, just wanted to take a second here. With all the storms that are going on and the flooding and wind damage, one thing we wanted to make sure the commission was aware of are the impacts of those storms on our hatchery system. And so I wanted to ask Ron to say a few words about that. Ron and Kelly and others have been out and about looking at the hatcheries, and we're in a scramble right now with our capital asset program to try and do some repairs and remove debris, et cetera. But Ron, if you could help me out for a second there.
You bet. Thanks, Joe. Commission, our recent events, it's really a unique situation I find myself in coming up in the agency in hatcheries, and when the rain's blowing sideways and I'm laying in bed at 2:00 in the morning, I find myself waiting to hear the alarm go off to roll out and go broom screen. So that's a problem of mine, but it's a good reminder that all of us should remember that when we have those events, we've got a lot of staff out across the state that are out fighting alarms, trying to protect state resources and doing a really good job. Just to give you a couple of situations, we've had a long history of flooding that's occurred mainly in western Washington. We've taken precautionary actions throughout the years to raise electrical panels and raise pumps and different things like that where we have ongoing events. Doesn't seem that we can raise them far enough. And so we had several facilities impacted by the floods during this last event, and still are trying to grasp the total impact that's occurred from the flood. To give you an idea, the Fallert Creek Hatchery Lower Klamath System, we had a couple of culverts plug up with large woody debris, trees and logs and different things. We had 5 feet of water in the hatchery building. As the water was rising, we had people walking in and out trying to keep fish alive, rodding incubators, doing things to while mud settling in the hatchery building, you know, kind of slogging through 2 to 3 feet of mud to walk down the line and keep water flowing until it just was no longer safe. Similarly, at Seuss Creek, have staff working around the clock in shifts of two where they have to get in and out of the hatchery. We have ropes between ponds and buildings to where you're walking across virtually 10 to 15,000 gallons a minute running between ponds and buildings, not in stream, but a new stream because of the floodwaters, and going into the building to make sure that our young fry and eggs are cared for so that we have ongoing opportunities in Puget Sound and in the lower Columbia River. We are still assessing loss. We know we've had significant loss at Lower Klamath, but we're still trying to assess that, and we'll provide that to the director in his report in January so that you're made aware of the actual numbers of fish loss. But that's just a small snippet of the damage and the floods that are impacting us, and willing to take any questions that you might have.
Any questions? I think.
I would like to reiterate what Deputy Director Storr said. CAMP, our Capital Asset Maintenance Program, they're at times sitting waiting for county roads to be reopened to get in and try to help us. It's a pretty unique opportunity and. Work that happens, and we're very connected in that way. Got a great crew, maintenance crew, that gets back in and helps us get cleaned up and put back together and operating as quickly as possible. So my thanks to them.
Thank you. And I know I speak for all of the commissioners that we are very appreciative of the staff doing going into harm's way daily to protect the resources of the state. And our thoughts are with you all, and our undying appreciation as well.
Thank you.
With that, I think we will break for lunch and reconvene at 1 o'clock.